Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Paradigm Project. Today, we are met by Mr. Dalton.
Hello.
One of our great seminar mentors, and co-hosting is Michael Clark.
Hi.
And I'm, of course, Winter Varner. Today, we're going to talk about China and how it's lasted so long just as a country, because it's pretty amazing, honestly. I mean, it's been how long?
We have a lot of information from archaeology and things like that that suggests that Chinese culture, or at least some versions of it, have been around for about 5,000 years.
Yeah.
So it's like when you learn about Egyptian history, like the pyramids and all that stuff, it kind of seems like China has a somewhat later start than Egypt, but Chinese civilization is arguably like still around in many of the same ways than it used to be. So if you think about like Egyptian civilization and how long ago that was, a good kind of benchmark is Egyptian civilization, but it just continued on where Egypt fell into decline.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's like so amazing that something that old can just like keep lasting. And like it has such a big impact on our world too, because China's like the largest, of course, like everybody knows that. Like geographically, it's the biggest. Maybe not in like number of people, but
which they
still
are still pretty close there.
Yeah.
I think they're second in terms of world population. I think India is first.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. And in terms of like geographic size, China is pretty similar to the United States in size.
Yeah.
So when we look at like the lower 48 states. So the United States is also just geographically immense.
Huge.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so is China. And I do think that like plays a role as far as like geography goes and how long that they've been able to stick around. And we'll talk about how Chinese territory has kind of grown and shrank over the years.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that plays a part into it, is just their geographic size, just how big it is.
Yeah.
Mm. It supports a lot of people.
Yeah.
And there are so many factors that go into it. I mean, as I researched, I learned a little bit about like their agriculture, things like that. It's just, there's so much there that goes into making it such a powerful and successful country.
Yeah. If you want to like, again, like it's useful to compare things with things that we know already. So the United States, we have a population of like 350 million, I think, somewhere near there.
Yeah.
China is at like 1.1 billion. So if we just did some like simple,
holy cow,
you know, like 3.5 times the amount of people that live in the United States,
mm-hmm,
that's what we would see in China.
Wow.
And most of the people are along like coastal cities. So huge, like we think of like New York City as being like ultra dense. We have like skyscrapers and stuff like that, right? But cities like Shanghai and especially like Hong Kong, extremely dense cities. People, packed into coastal cities and just very dense. But then also because the country is so big, they have a lot of open space as well, which is where their agriculture comes from.
It's incredible. Anyway, we need to get started. So the first thing I wanted to ask about was tradition. Do you think, like in your research, have you found any traditions in current modern day China that have just persisted a long time, whether it's in Chinese literature or just in general?
Yeah, I think as far as China's like recent history, historians and archaeologists and like social and political historians, I think fairly separate Chinese history into dynastic history and then communist history.
Mm-hmm.
Or even like, because there's a period of history where they're not communist. So it's like pre-dynastic and post-dynastic China.
Mm-hmm.
And early on in the post-dynastic China, so the more recent China, we do start to see kind of like a rejection of old cultural traditions,
mm-hmm,
and an embracing of new ideas and new things.
Mm-hmm.
But now in like the last 30 to 40 years, we've started to see culture and traditions from more ancient times and from people like Confucius and big philosophical thinkers from China. Those traditions are starting to become more popular, or at least utilized by the state again,
mm-hmm,
because it's what people know. And I think that the Chinese government is starting to recognize that they were effective in some ways.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that part of that denial and reacceptance could have to do with Mao's death? Because I know that part of that was the Cultural Revolution and just the ultra denial of tradition and embrace working and stuff like that. Do you think that they're connected?
Yeah, I think that's a reasonable assumption to make, or a reasonable like line of thinking. I think there are a number of factors that probably played a role in it, especially in the 1980s, kind of similar to what is happening in the Soviet Union. at the time. There's a lot of public discontent with the government. And so we see a lot of protests. One protest that gets brought up quite a bit are like pro-democracy protests, like the ones that we see at Tiananmen Square with like the tanks and the guy standing in the middle of the road. But there are a lot of like pro-democracy protests in the 1980s. And then with Mao's death, which I think happens in the late 70s. And then, yeah, that is kind of like a relaxation of the like really stringent and strict, just pure communist thinking. Mm-hmm. And they do start to pursue other avenues of thought and ideas. And I think what Xi Jinping has done, Xi Jinping is the current president, or he's the current head of the Communist Party in China. So he's basically the de facto ruler. Mm-hmm. In recent history and under President Xi Jinping, they have started to re-embrace ideas, especially like Confucianism. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if we would have seen those same kind of things under Mao.
Yeah.
I think that's something that Mao might not necessarily agree with,
mm-hmm.
but it's something that in the last 30 to 40 years, different leadership throughout China has started to try to bring it back. Like mm-hmm. they've opened Confucius schools. They've started to change the way that they recruit for political positions and things like that. They're trying to fix things like corruption. And so what they try to do is bring in philosophy that Confucius shared his ideas because he saw a corrupt society. And mm-hmm. so he's like, how can we fix this corruption that we see in society? And I think Xi Jinping and other Chinese leaders are like, okay, we see a lot of corruption again.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we start to implement or at least adapt based on what we see and bring in some of those older traditions back?
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
That's super crazy. And it's interesting to see them bringing it back after it. I mean, that philosophy and just Confucianism alone, and I'm sure there's so much more, that has lasted for centuries upon centuries. What are the values associated with that philosophy and what gives it such significant value that they're bringing it back even in the present day?
Confucianism, there are a number of ways to think about it. One way that I always remembered it when I was a student is it is fundamentally a way to understand how you fit into society, what role you should serve as an individual, and your behavior as an individual within a society. And so you kind of have different levels. You have different levels of kind of the levels of respect or deference that you show to other people. To kind of boil this down to, I think, understandable terms, when you first start to learn about Confucianism, you initially start to learn about the role that Confucianism has in like the family life.
Mm-hmm.
So Confucianism, before it's adopted into kind of like today's communism and like today's China, so like ancient forms of Confucianism or dynastic versions of Confucianism, is there's a big emphasis on the family, and it's a male-dominated family structure, and it's also dominated by age. So the older you are, the more respect you should get. The male members of the family should get more respect. So, for example, to kind of give you an extreme, a young male child, like a 2-year-old male child, should receive different treatment and be treated with a certain level of respect that his 18-year-old sister might not even receive.
Mm.
And so that is kind of like a very basic level of Confucianism. But then what we can do is say, all right, so the person at the top of a family structure would be like a grandfather, right?
Mm-hmm.
An older male head of the family.
Mm-hmm.
So that is kind of like one level of confusion is the family. Then we can extend that outward to say, okay, what about your community? Still, your males are going to be more dominant and older people are going to be generally just more respected. Then if we take it like outside of your city or hometown or your neighborhood, and we expand it to the country, we expand it to the state.
Mm-hmm.
In dynastic times, the most respected person was the emperor. So they are like at the tippy top. They are, even contradictorily, even if it is a child emperor, that emperor should receive all of the respect in the world because they are at the top.
Mm-hmm.
They deserve the most respect. They reserve the best treatment. And so it's kind of assumed, just like you would, you know, treat your grandfather with respect and kindness and care, you treat the state with kindness and respect and care. And to bring it back down to the family level again, the firstborn son's responsibility would be to go and achieve something. A lot. It depends on the time period that we're looking at. Sometimes that would be to go to war. Sometimes that would be to go and achieve like political success or academic success.
Mm-hmm.
But if we want, that would be the male's responsibility to the family.
But what about the male's responsibility or even the daughter's responsibility to the state? And so just like that male family member, his responsibility for his family is to go and achieve political success. The state also expects him to go and achieve political success. So it's kind of similar to almost, if you've ever heard of dharma in Hindu religions, mm-hmm. you fulfill your dharma. Mm-hmm. So if you are a baker, you be the absolute best baker that you can possibly be, right? And I think that's an idea or a concept that we're a little bit more familiar with in the West. You fulfill your role to the best that you possibly can. The added thing with Confucianism and also in Hinduism is that there are gender roles wrapped up in that as well. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of the gender role aspect of things that have kind of been pushed away and forgotten by more like recent implementations of Confucianism in China. It's just like, we kind of threw that away with the Cultural Revolution, mm-hmm. like the differences between men and women. And so like, that's not as big of an aspect of it anymore, but certainly like your role within society, mm-hmm. fulfill your role within society and do it well and do it with respect and do it with benevolence and honesty and honor your family and fulfill what your family needs you to do. And so it's all wrapped up in like, what is your individual responsibility? How do you fulfill it to the best of your ability? How do you support your family as best as you possibly can? And by doing all of those things, you're also supporting the state that you best possibly can. So it's a whole philosophy of like, me as an individual, I can behave in a way that creates a good and beneficial society because I improve my family, because I improve my community, because I improve my state. So it's something that starts off on an individualistic level, but it really is actually emphasizing the community. And I think that's one distinction between like the United States and China, or even just the West and China, or the West and the East, is the West focuses so much on the individual. And I think we incorrectly say that the East focuses on the community. That's not entirely true. They focus on the individual to support the community. And I think there's a big distinction there.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. So how do you think that embracement of the elder generation promotes tradition? Like in families, if you are encouraged to treat your elders with the utmost respect, do you think that that would make the people in the generation more likely to pertain to their elders' values?
That's a really good question. There is something to be said of like Chinese society today that should probably be mentioned, in that I don't know how many of the older, again, I'm speaking from a person who can only look at China really secondhand. You know, I know some of the language, but I can't like scroll on Weibo and like, mm-hmm. you know, get a sense of like what the people think. But just from what we hear from probably somewhat flawed, like other sources, is that there might be, from what we see, is that there might be a big disconnect between the youth, like the young people in China today, and what the government wants to steer them towards, kind of that respect towards the like elders. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure. I think if we were like kind of operating in like the best possible case scenario for them, they would say, yeah, like that's what we want. That's mm-hmm. like our goal. Is to have, you know, children being able to look at ancestors, or not ancestors because that's slightly different, but look at like living elders mm-hmm. and say like, yeah, I can follow their example, or I can understand my life better by looking at their lives better. Mm-hmm. And I do think kind of similar to what's happening in the United States is like, and we see happen throughout time, is young people sometimes don't really want to listen. And I think that it's like fair. It's fair that, you know, they might want to reject the ways and means that their grandparents had done things. And I do think it's kind of unfair to like judge too quickly for that, because the world is changing much more quickly than it did, you know, in 1100 BCE. Mm-hmm. Like the way of life, you know, you lived the exact same way fundamentally that your grandparents did, or even your great, 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 great grandparents did. Like life had not really fundamentally changed. Mm-hmm. But now in China, over the last 100 years, we go from literally like 95% of people in China are farmers in like the 1940s to now we have pretty much like a big split of like people living in cities and people living in rural areas. So we're kind of, they're going through kind of the late stages of an industrial revolution where they're seeing huge changes in the way that their life is from the way that their grandparents' lives lived. And I think that's something that the Chinese government is struggling to kind of do when they try to implement or re-implement Confucian ideas, is like, we live, and like young adults live so much differently than people did even just like 50 years ago, which that was not the case even just 300 years ago. 300 years ago, people lived the exact same way that they did 1500 years ago, like very few differences. But now that's completely different. It's totally changed.
Wow. I think it's interesting that you bring up, as we discuss the relationship between the elder members of society and the younger, you also brought up the ways in which the state intends to steer young people.
Yeah.
How do you think that the state has steered young people throughout time? How has that affected China today?
In China specifically?
Yeah, and throughout history.
Yeah. Again, Confucianism, there's a reason why the Chinese government is trying to bring it back, at least in some ways. And when I say try to bring it back, I really do mean like try to rescue it from kind of a near destruction. It was like nearly completely removed from political thought from China. But that does not necessarily mean that the people living in China had it removed from them. So even if the government was not fully in support of Confucianism, that was the way that people lived. Like that was their values. And so I think the family has a role in society, and the family's role in society is to create benevolent. And Confucius uses a term that's translated into English as being gentleman or being, you know, proper or benevolent or honest. And so the family's role is to steer their children into a person that will make them beneficial and honest and responsible in society. And so the state really doesn't have to do very much because the family does it for them. And so the family's role is to get their son to fulfill their role the best, or to get their daughter to fulfill their role the best. So all the state really has to do is provide opportunities for that to actually happen. And that's actually one thing that would be good to talk about, is when the state or when the dynasty fails to make those opportunities, that's when people in China historically have been, we need to cause some change. We need to end this dynasty and potentially start a new one. It's because these opportunities that we expect to have, right, to be able to go and pursue political success, to be able to go and pursue, you know, aristocratic success or artistic success, is those opportunities have dried up and people blame the state. And so they go to overthrow the state. And so the state really just has to, you know, protect the people, make for opportunities for them to work and live and be happy. And the families and the individuals themselves take care of the rest. So I don't know if there's too much like actual purposeful like steering of the young people throughout history. Mm-hmm. I think you can make that argument a little bit more for like recent history. And that's just because of things like social media and things like that, where a state or a government can share a lot of more information very easily to anyone. But when we look at it historically, when that was difficult, right, the emperor can't go door to door and being like, hey, we'd really like your nephew to, you know, take the civil service exam and become a politician. It's not how it works. Instead, that's what the family does. Family's like, and this is, there's kind of the stereotype of every family in China would absolutely love for their children to be doctors or engineers or scientists, is because that's what they perceive as being the best possible thing that you can do for society. And so they want their kid to go and do that thing, which one will make them successful, but will also benefit society. So that's kind of why we see so many like stereotypes of the Asian doctor or engineer. Is because there is some truth to it. It's like, yeah, we want our children to serve the best possible roles in society. We want them to be successful themselves. We also want them to help us. Like when we as parents get older, We want to make sure that our kids are financially secure enough to be able to help and care for us, which is another big aspect of Confucianism.
I think it's super interesting, too, that China has existed for so long that exactly how it came into being isn't exactly known. There's a lot of like tradition and myth and legend that goes into it. How do you think that that has affected how they look at things? Because, I mean, in America, we are so focused on like the details of our founding, I feel like.
Yeah. Yeah. And to be fair, the kind of like the recent like post-dynastic China has kind of taken a cue from the West to draw more attention to like recent history, especially like the founding. Mm-hmm. And so there is a big emphasis on people like Mao, and for good reason. They feel that he is like one of the founders of their country. But yeah, going back further, I think probably one of the best things, well, there's a couple. So when you look at the kind of list of Chinese dynasties throughout history, we have a couple pretty long time ago, like 3,000 years ago. Some archaeologists even say like 4,000 years ago. I'm thinking in BCE terms, in BC terms. So right. Like 3,000 BC is kind of when we think they started, but other archaeologists can draw that further back. And the reasons why we would extend like those societies to be similar today is we see the same types of writing. We see the same types of like state building. So same types of like leaders and how things are done. Same type of politics. We think we have a pretty good idea. And so when a Chinese person or, you know, a Chinese student learns about their own history, they would learn about those dynasties and understand that like, yeah, they might not be exactly how we live today, but that is our founding. That like, and we were, and they do have a lot of mythology involved, which is really fun to learn about. It's like we have this mythology, and we have these stories, but then also there's probably some reality to those stories. And so it's just like we hear with like George Washington and like Benjamin Franklin, like those guys have myths and stories surrounding them, which serve a purpose, right? They serve, you know, like not telling a lie or just being so intellectually curious, like Benjamin Franklin, that those legends and those myths and those stories and the same way that they learn about it is just like, yeah, this is where our society comes from, but it's not 300 years ago. It's 5,000 years ago. And then something that I'll mention just really quickly is one, at least one Western way that people look at Chinese dynasties is it's like a cycle or it's like a wave. I was mentioning earlier how when people are dissatisfied with their government, they overthrow it. There's this concept called manifest destiny in Chinese history. And it's basically the approval of the gods on the way that the country is being run. And if the Chinese government, if the, you know, the king or the emperor loses manifest destiny, he's lost the approval of the gods. And so it is now within the rights of the people to overthrow him. And I think that that's actually like a much more related idea to concepts that we have in the West that I think that other people don't really think about. It's like, yeah, when we look at like the Declaration of Independence, it's all about like, yeah, the people living in the colonies felt like their government no longer served them in the ways that they wanted. And so they wanted to break away. So when we look at like things like the American Revolution, there's also a parallel in Chinese history, only they've done it like a dozen times.
Wow. That's crazy.
So that when manifest destiny is lost, there's a huge revolution. The king or the emperor gets overthrown. A new dynasty pops up, lasts for 700 or 800 years. They lose the manifest destiny. Cycle starts all over again. Mm. We've only had one cycle. Not to say that, like, you know, the government's going to get overthrown sometime in the future. Right. But at least as far as Chinese historical thinking goes, like, that's just the way that it works. Right. Like, governments can't rule forever. Something's got to change about them at some point. Mm-hmm. That's what has been happening in Chinese history for 5,000 years.
To draw attention to another idea that's usually associated with Eastern culture, although not necessarily China, it's almost like reincarnation, where like there are different lifetimes and different ways of living, different kinds of success that China gets to see and learn from, which is crazy.
I like that we've come back to Dharma twice now.
Yeah.
Even though we're not talking about it.
And China does have like a Buddhist tradition, and I'm not as well known on that subject. My stuff is definitely more political than I know about. But yeah, Buddhism is kind of like an extension, kind of like a progression of Hindu belief. And so there is that aspect of it. Those people that are Buddhist in China, which for much of Chinese history has been most Chinese people, has been Buddhist. And yeah, I do think that there's an element of that. And one thing that I would say that is, you know, Buddhist or non-Buddhist or even like Christian or Muslim, whatever it might be, especially within the Han Chinese population, we're starting to get down into very big specifics here. But Han Chinese is when you think of a Chinese person from Beijing or from Hong Kong, they are Han Chinese. There are other ethnicities in China as well. But when we're talking about the Han Chinese, those are the people that have been around for about 5,000 years, or so many Han Chinese scholars and Western scholars would argue. Those Han Chinese have a belief structure of ancestors. So while some of them might be Buddhist and believe in things like reincarnation, nearly all Han Chinese believe in a concept of ancestors, and that your ancestors are aware of what you're doing and of what your family's doing. And you know, you need to not only make them proud and happy and, you know, satisfied, but you also need to care for them. And so that's where like religious ritual and things enter into kind of politics. The Confucius, not only is he emphasizing like the role of the family and the individual and the state, he's also emphasizing the role of ritual. And one of the main rituals is the honoring of ancestors. And you kind of pay homage to your background and to your history and to the people that came before you. And that's a huge emphasis of Confucianism as well. And again, why I think, generally speaking, there is a huge emphasis on history and culture, even within just China itself, is that they are constantly, you know, paying homage to ancestors. Every holiday thing that you see about like lighting lanterns, for example, if you've ever gone to like a lantern festival for the Chinese New Year, if you've ever seen people light incense and pray, all of that is ancestors. All of that is prayer to people in their families that came before them. And so, well, I don't know, like, other than Buddhists, what kind of a level they think of like reincarnation and things like that. Certainly they do believe in the importance of where they came from and the people that lived before them, and to want to make those people proud and feel well served because they believe that they're still with us.
Do you think that this system of beliefs is maybe not the main reason, but at least one of the contributing reasons to China's resilience as a country, as a group of people?
Yeah, I think the cynical part of me wants to give credit to other things as well. But I do think that their philosophy has been hugely instrumental, especially in just creating a stable political system. One event in Chinese history that is just completely shocking to me, and probably one of the reasons why I started to study China in the first place, is Genghis Khan. Genghis Khan creates the largest world empire ever seen in human history. And what does he do? As soon as he conquers China and basically the rest of the world, he moves to China and he basically becomes a Chinese emperor. He is no longer a Mongol warlord. He instead is like, no, yeah, the way that the Chinese are doing things is pretty much perfect. I just want to be the one benefiting from it. And so he's like, I'm just going to keep things the way that they're going and not really change much. And I'm just going to basically extend the Chinese political system and rule my empire like a Chinese emperor. And so he doesn't feel the need to change anything, even though he conquers pretty much most of the known world except for Europe and North Africa. And he's like, yeah, this is good. I'm very pleased with this. This is like the perfect way to run a society. I have nothing to change.
That's wild. I feel like most conquerors and revolutionaries in history will make the movements that they do because they want to see some huge change.
Yeah.
The fact that he is pretty satisfied with where things are at.
Yeah, he's kind of similar to at least the stories that we hear about Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great was told that he would rule the world. And so he went on a mission to fulfill that. And Genghis Khan is told the same thing as a child. He's told, you will rule everything under the sky. And he's like, okay, I'm going to go do everything I can to make sure that's true. Mm-hmm. There's no real vision behind it other than he's told that he's going to rule the world. And so he's like, all right, mm-hmm. I'm going to go do that. I don't really have a grand vision to do anything good or evil. I'm just going to go and conquer the world, yeah. Which does turn out to be pretty evil.
Well, I feel like just like as American high schoolers, like as what we are, we see social change, like the point of it is revolution. And revolution is like growth and, I don't know, just general getting better, you know. But that's not always the reason that change happens. Like we're kind of given that bias.
Like what do you even call it, a bias? Progress is always going forward.
Yeah.
Progress is always good.
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. what we're like taught to think, but that's not always true. Progress can just be moving on sometimes. Progress can be downward, which is really unfortunate. We don't like it, but it's true. It's interesting to look at it from that different perspective. Just that even though things are happening, it doesn't mean they're good or bad. They're just kind of happening. Yeah. And there's not much we can do about that.
And this like very... This scientific revolution that has driven so much progress in the last like couple of centuries, mm-hmm. it's weird to think that there doesn't necessarily have to be a reason for everything. Sometimes there's just something happening.
Yeah. And we can try to place meaning on it, and we can try to understand it better. Like we could say that Genghis Khan just wanted to first unite the people of the Mongol steppe, and then... You know, he just wanted to conquer southern or northern China. Mm. Or we could say that he was, you know, a grand visionary. But yeah, we're just trying to apply patterns or ways of thinking that we don't really know. Like we don't really know for sure. And so, yeah, I think that's one of the fun things of history is like, am I seeing a pattern or is this just imaginary? You know?
Yeah.
So it looks like we are at the end of our time. We want to thank you so much for coming on. And we like to do this thing where we give our listeners a little challenge for the week. Just okay. Something to keep them occupied. Do you have any ideas?
No, I mean, you challenged me with something. I don't know.
I'd say from this, my challenge would be take a look from a different perspective, whether it's time-wise, like we've been talking about, or tradition-wise, or philosophy.
Okay, now I understand. Sorry, I thought you were challenging me with something, but I'm kind of okay. I see what you're saying. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would say as a challenge, think about what you know about yourself and your community, and your country and the world, and humbly accept. I wouldn't even say think about, I would say just humbly accept that you don't know as much as you think. Even me, and I'm not saying this as like the adult in the room, I don't know anything. And what I would say to challenge you is accept that fact and always be in the pursuit to get away from that. It's like accept that you know very little or nothing, but always try to break that fact.
Well, thank you so much for coming on today. You were a great guest.
This has been an amazing discussion. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to The Paradigm Project. Please rate us 5 stars on iTunes. It helps us share the great conversation of ideas with more people. If you want to get in contact with us, you can either shoot us an email at podcast@paradigmhigh.org or you can DM us on Instagram @theparadigmpod.